Tonight on the Daily Debrief.
He just can't leave me alone.
The trial of a Wisconsin judge accused of stalking his own court clerk. Plus, closing arguments in the case of three Chicago cops accused of covering up this deadly shooting. And the president picks a new nominee for U.S. Attorney General. That's tonight on the Daily Debrief for Friday, December 7th.
Good breaking news right off the top of the Daily Debrief tonight. We have just learned from federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York that they are recommending rather so-called substantial prison time for President Donald Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen. That recommendation for substantial prison time relates to campaign finance violations Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to. They included tax fraud, excessive campaign contributions, lying to a financial institution, and unlawful corporate contributions. Those charges are unrelated to separate accusations coming from the Office of Special Counsel Robert Mueller. We understand that he just split seconds ago, released a separate sentencing recommendation. We're combing through these documents as we speak. You can go to lawandcrime.com to read the documents for yourself, and we will update you as soon as we are able. Let's move on now to day two of testimony in the criminal prosecution of an attorney made famous by the hit Netflix film Making a Murderer. For a time, represented murder defendant Brendan Dassey. Dassey admitted at least some involvement in the murder of Teresa Halbach before Kaczynski was even on the case. But the accusations of Kaczynski and his investigator not doing their jobs properly enraged audiences worldwide. Kaczynski went on to become a municipal judge in northeastern Wisconsin after he was booted off the case. He's charged with stalking his law clerk, a felony. The whole thing started as a personnel dispute, which resulted in a restraining order. Kaczynski faced two misdemeanors for violating the restraining order, but the prosecutor dropped them 2 days before the trial. What remains is the stalking charge, and here is what the state must prove, that a reasonable person would suffer serious emotional distress after the defendant's conduct, that the defendant knew this victim would suffer or should have known it, and that this victim actually did suffer. The possible penalty is that Kaczynski faces a $10,000 fine and up to 3.5 years in prison if convicted. Let's go straight to testimony now in this case. The woman who accused Kaczynski of stalking was the state's first witness. In this next clip, she testifies about a bizarre email she received from Kaczynski after getting other county leaders involved.
Exhibit?
Yes.
What is it?
It is an email to me wishing my husband a happy Father's Day.
And who is it from?
It is from Len Kaczynski.
And what's the subject line of that email?
The subject line is rule violation.
And can you read the entirety of that email? I know it's a short one.
He states, Mandy, I realize that this email violates every principle we've talked about regarding office conduct the last few weeks, but I am sending it anyway. Feel free to report me to HR. I feel spunky this morning. Happy Father's Day to your husband, Doug.
Thank you. How did you feel when you read this email?
I thought we talked about things over and over and over and over at this point in time, and it continues.
In reading that email, did you believe he would abide by your wishes to keep things professional?
I was hoping so, but no.
Spunky on Father's Day. Well, later the victim said Kaczynski made threats when no one else was present.
Actually physically got up, went over the desk and asked me, are you afraid of me now? Because I was sitting there and I was by myself. And he sat there and asked me if I was afraid because nobody else was around.
What was the volume level of his voice when he said that?
He was whispering.
Was your office service window open at the time?
Yes.
How did you react at that time?
I was in shock that he was actually leaning over, knocking my things over, knocking my kids' pictures over, and asking me if I was actually afraid of him and in my face.
That incident came after the victim asked for a third party to be present with her meetings with Len Kaczynski. The victim went on to describe living in fear, but refusing to quit because she needed the job and the benefits.
Did you still feel scared or harassed by the actions of the defendant?
Pretty much on a daily basis, yes.
Now, did this blend into your home life in any way?
Absolutely.
In what way?
Either it was like I was crying or yelling or upset, to the point where we would get on the phone with each other because I have two boys. I mean, we had to take care of them, and all I did was argue about he just can't leave me alone. And it was a point where it was every day my husband would go, what's next? What did he do today? And I would say every single day. As I stated, there could have been upwards of 10 emails, maybe one, maybe zero, but it was just every single day. And it was sometimes, you know, we should have been doing family things, and we weren't, because I was griping to my husband about everything that I was going through.
Did you take any precautions at home to make yourself feel better?
Absolutely.
What'd you do?
At home, we do have an alarm system on our house. There was a time where we'd come home, and a second we came home, we put that on, we shut our curtains. I was scared.
Examination, the victim was forced to acknowledge that at one point she did have a very close relationship with Len Kaczynski.
He was in the hospital.
Okay, and at that time he was limited and not supposed to leave the hospital, correct?
He was not supposed to leave, that is correct, which I did not know until later.
Okay, but so he did come up and participate in that race that day?
He did, yes.
And you were actually at the finish line cheering him on when he completed?
Yes, because I participated as well as my husband and my boys.
So you and your boys and your husband were there cheering him on when he completed?
As well as our human resources and Karen Nagorny, who actually ended the race with him.
Okay.
And this is when I'm cheering him on, making sure, he has his medical issues, and I am encouraging him. So it says, Judge Kay, you did a great job today. We're all there for you today. Please let me know when you're up to or how you're feeling. It was a lot today, but I know you are such a strong person. Glad to see you, and truly brought tears to my eyes when you crossed the finish line, knowing how hard you fight. You have such a great family and friend support. Talk with you soon.
Okay. So, I mean, at this point in time, he's a friend to you.
Absolutely, and I was supporting him through his GVDB crisis.
Okay. And in fact, you would call him a good friend at this point.
I wouldn't call him a good friend. I wouldn't say good friend. I didn't tell him my deepest, darkest secrets. I would say friend, yes.
He was careful to nuance the exact nature of the relationship. The next witness, the alleged victim's husband, testified that he needed to check in on his wife to make sure she was okay at work.
She was worried about what the next day would come to be, what would happen. Was she going to get another email? Was she going to get any kind of, reprimands, things of that nature? So that continued to escalate throughout 2017. Towards the end of 2017, I think the emotions certainly heightened, as did the events around her. Being frightened, being terrified would be a couple of good words to illustrate her behavior. And again, truly was on a daily basis. I certainly stopped there on multiple times just to check in on her, whether it be at lunch, if I had some extra time at the end of the day, pop on in. I had to go right past. May as well see how she's doing, what transpired throughout the day if I hadn't heard from her. There were other occasions where there was an email of significance that I would stop over there. A couple occasions I went over there immediately in the middle of my day.
Juvenile Court Judge Ashley Wilcott is our guest tonight here on the Daily Debrief. Also, of course, host here at the Law and Crime Network. Good to see you on the other side of the table.
Thank
Not that
you,
I
Aaron.
Dislike you on this side either. But
happy
but look,
to be here.
So the state needs to prove a complicated statute here. Based on what we know thus far in this case, how well do you think the state is proving it?
I think they're doing a very good job proving it, Aaron. And here's the reason. Because the prosecution walked her from testimony of odd behavior all the way to him saying you better be psychologically prepared, seeking out family, sending letters, and actually doing things that I think a reasonable person would be in fear.
Okay, so the defense promised to call witnesses to say, hey, Len was eccentric, Len was socially awkward, maybe he was a little bit creepy. Is that an effective way to try to prove this reasonable person prong of the statute, that a lot of people wouldn't consider this over the line?
Well, I think that's the issue, is where is that line? Do all of those things mitigate that line or say, hey, because he's kind of creepy and odd, then this line gets pushed a little further? Absolutely. But I still think she has testified to things that cross that line into criminal activity.
You said a couple of minutes ago that you love watching this case, and I hope I'm not putting you on the spot
by repeating that
back, but why do you like this case so much?
I'm enthralled by this case because here you have a judge like myself, a municipal court judge, and we just don't know what's going to happen. He's been stalking, potentially.
All right, we're going to follow the case, of course. Still ahead tonight, though, on the Daily Debrief, a new nominee for the position of U.S. Attorney General. Plus, we're going to bring you back to closing arguments in the case of three Chicago cops accused of covering up this deadly officer-involved shooting. An update, folks, to the breaking news we brought you off the top of the broadcast involving the sentencing recommendation from the Southern District of New York regarding the president's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen. That recommendation from the Southern District of New York is that Michael Cohen should serve substantial prison time on campaign finance violations. I mentioned that Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's office was going to join in this discussion and that he had just filed a separate recommendation. Here is what that recommendation says from Mueller's office. It says that he doesn't have an official position on the sentence, but that Michael Cohen made substantial efforts to remediate his bad conduct. That's what the special counsel is saying at this point. Of course, you can read the documents on lawandcrime.com. An official sentencing is set for this coming Wednesday. Let's move on now. President Trump has selected a new nominee for the position of U.S. Attorney General. William Barr is the planned nominee President Trump confirmed today. Barr previously served as Attorney General under the first President Bush from 91 till 93. He went on to work as General Counsel for Verizon. During his initial tenure as Attorney General, Barr supervised Robert Mueller, of course, the current special counsel, investigating Russian interference with the U.S. presidential election. Now to Anthony Velez with a recap of interesting, newsworthy criminal incidents.
Here are today's top crime stories trending on lawandcrime.com and across the country. A reported member of MS-13 from El Salvador was sentenced to 30 years in prison for his role in a gang-related slaying in Virginia. Walter Antonio Argueta Amaya pleaded guilty in the brutal killing of 24-year-old Marvin Joel Riviera Guevara in Scottsville in July 2017. Amaya and other MS-13 members allegedly hacked Guevara to death with machetes, reportedly delivering more than 140 laceration wounds to the victim. Amaya, who is an undocumented immigrant, pleaded guilty to first-degree murder and murder by lynching and was sentenced to 15 years for each count. Authorities in Ohio released the daring dashcam footage of the dramatic moments a deputy stopped a suicidal man from jumping off an overpass. Deputy William Ball of the Franklin County Sheriff's Office reportedly saw the unidentified man on Interstate 270 looking over the overpass wall. Ball pulled over and engaged the man before leaping into action, stopping the reportedly distraught man from killing himself. The man was taken to a hospital for a mental evaluation. Authorities in Washington looking for a suspect who promised to turn himself in when he responded to the department's Facebook post listing him as a wanted man finally got their man. 38-year-old Anthony Akers reportedly saw the post on the Richland Police Department's Facebook page and promised to turn himself in within 48 hours, but apparently got cold feet and stood up his date with justice. The jilted department asked Akers why he didn't show up, and he gave the criminal equivalent of a "it's not you, it's me" speech. Akers eventually turned himself in, but not before posting a picture of himself outside of the precinct with the caption, "Here for our date, sweetheart." Akers is now serving 1 month in jail for failure to comply. Those were today's top crime stories. I'm Anthony Velez for the Daily Debrief.
Now to the case of an alleged cop cover-up in Chicago, Illinois. This all surrounds the video we've seen many times here, which shows Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke shooting and killing the knife-wielding teenager you see in the center of your screen, Laquan McDonald. One jury convicted Officer Van Dyke of second-degree murder, but now three other officers are on trial. The three men are accused of conspiracy, official misconduct, and obstruction of justice. Prosecutors say they lied in their official reports by claiming Laquan McDonald attacked the officer who shot him. David March was the only defendant to call a witness in this case. That witness was a former Chicago police officer who said she was the one who attached David March's names to many of those reports.
Do you see the date and time near David March's name that you put in there?
I do.
And what is that?
21 October 2014, 15:01 hours.
Knowing that it has the identical date and time as your report, does that mean you're the person that put March's name on Officer Fontaine's report?
Yes.
All right. Prior to that, did David March, to your knowledge, have access to Officer Fontaine's report? And on Officer Fontaine's report, does it say, after you inputted David March's name and contact information, does it say that Officer Strike that? Does it say that Detective March reviewed Officer Fontaine's report?
No.
Does it say that Detective March approved Officer Fontaine's report?
No.
The other defendants are basically saying that the state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they committed a crime. None of the defendants took the stand. Closing arguments yesterday afternoon began with the prosecution. The state focused heavily on the differences between the officer's reports and the video of the shooting.
Defendant March falsely included McGilligan as a victim in order to support justification for the killing of Laquan McDonald. That's not supported by the video. Violating public trust, official misconduct, obstruction of justice. Proved beyond a reasonable doubt, right in black and white. We're here because these officers and others tried to make the case against Van Dyke go away. Laquan McDonald was a human being. He deserved due process and the law, and not to have police officers write false reports and shape a false narrative to justify his killing. Filing a false police report in order to protect a fellow officer from prosecution is not honorable. It's not sticking up for a colleague. It's a violation of the public trust. It's a violation of their oath of office. It's a violation of the law. It's obstruction of justice. And agreeing together to violate the law in this way and taking an act in furtherance of that agreement is conspiracy. We wholeheartedly agree that being a police officer is a dangerous job. It's public service at its highest. We have the utmost respect for the thousands of police officers who serve and protect all of the people in this city. But along with that authority to serve and protect comes the responsibility as sworn officers to respect the law for all citizens.
The defense for David March pushed the focus back on the victim.
I can't think of one law Laquan McDonald followed. And they don't address that, Judge. They don't talk about it, Judge. They don't talk about Laquan McDonald's crimes. They gloss over if they even mention that he had a knife. They completely ignore Rudy Barillas. They don't talk about him. They don't highlight his name on police reports. They refuse to accept that Officer Gaffney is a victim of an aggravated assault, a felony, a forcible felony. They refuse to accept that Officer McGilligan is following this armed offender for blocks. And he continuously asks, he demands, he pleads with McDonald to stop and drop the knife. McDonald ignores all of those commands. The prosecution doesn't want to talk about that. Well, the police officers out there that night, they can't afford to ignore it. This case isn't about violating public trust. It's about McDonald violating the laws. It's about law and order.
That same animated attorney attacked the state's key witness, a fellow officer with a $90,000 a year salary.
Counsel says she has no reason to lie. That's wrong. She actually has 90,000 reasons to lie, along with some benefits. When she told an inspector general on March 16th of 2016 that McDonald was making attacking movements, when she told that same inspector general under oath on March 16th, but she doesn't recall telling David March that one line, she might have. You, Your Honor, can consider those under oath statements as if she said it in this courtroom today. It's substantial impeachment.
Back to Ashley Wilcott here for one last analysis of this case this week. So the defense attacked that key witness, Dora Fontaine, who basically had earlier accused the defendants of falsely attributing words and ideas to her. And that's the pushback. Oh, well, she herself has given inconsistent statements. So who do we believe here?
Who do we believe? I think that there's evidence of some kind of cover-up, and that, especially with the third-party emails, there's some kind of cover-up. Do I think that we can believe that there's an inference of these defendants made an agreement to do a cover-up? I don't think that's been proven. I do not think that they're going to be convicted of conspiracy.
Okay, so the judge has to issue the decision in this case. There's no jury. The judge said she will issue the decision at a specific date. On a specific time. If you were that judge, because you are a judge, how would you go about this one?
I would do the statute, and next to that, every note that I had from all of the evidence that she took copious notes, and I would start applying those facts to the statute to determine which of the charges I find beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, so making a clear record for an appellate court as
well. Absolutely. That's what you have to do as a judge, and you better put all of that, Aaron, in the order that you issue.
Okay, what do you think about the prosecution's closing there? There were a lot of lofty generalities, theories, city upon a hill, we want to have officers who are beyond reproach. How does that really prove the case, though?
I don't think it really proves the case. I just think that they were trying to prove, hey, listen, we get all of these ideas around it, but the truth of the matter is these three did conspire. I don't know that it was very compelling for a judge, whereas with a jury, it may have been received differently.
Yeah, I mean, some of the argument style as well, you know, the bombastic arguments from the one attorney, he's great to listen to, but does that have as much of an effect on a judge who's used to sort of cutting through that?
For me, it would have the opposite effect, which is I don't need the theatrics, I need the facts.
I can understand that. Well, Judge Wilcott, we always appreciate your insight, and
thanks,
I will cede the seat back to you for your own hosting segment next time.
Thank you, Aaron.
Okay, that's all the time we have for the Daily Debrief tonight. A reminder that our live coverage here on the Law and Crime Network will pick up Monday at 9 a.m. We are live from 9 to 5 with trials and hearings from around the country. I will see you on the Daily Debrief starting at 5 p.m. Eastern. From all of us here at the Law and Crime Network, have a good evening and a good weekend. We'll see you Monday.